So where we started a few weeks ago now, because we're only doing this every couple of weeks, was going back to the Cohen seminar from September, where we had bumped into two really apparently opposing senses of what it is to be a self within practice. The first sense that came out of the Dongshan Cohen, when it's cold, the cold kills you, and when it's hot, the heat kills you, giving us that sense of a self that's really permeated and taken over by everything that's around it, and that's very permeable and has no distinct identity. And then on the contrary, the second thing that's actually not a koan, but a commentary on a koan, where the infant Buddha, supposedly able to talk, gets up and says, above the heavens, below the earth, I alone am the world honor one. It's bad to call it Frank Sinatra, I did it my way, and it really isn't that way, but you know, somehow being really filled with a sense of self or of oneself. And what we've been doing is trying to look at how those two opposing senses of personhood really maybe emerge as part of a kind of classic Zen archetypal narrative. And we've been tracing that through the 8th century poem by Shito Shichen, the great Chan teacher. And that poem, as we've noted, is part of the afternoon readings that we do during a retreat. So where we'd been, and I won't go over all of this, but the Shito poem starts with a sort of the great dark mysterious, and then with an inextricable intermingling of light and dark, of what we can know and what we can't know. And I want to come at this two different ways. On the one hand, in terms of a kind of classic narrative of practice, which grows out of this sort of mythic cosmological story, one thing comes first, then another thing comes after that. And in that sense, going into the darkness seems to be the prerequisite for what comes after it. And I think in an important sense, that's true. It would be terrible if you interpreted that as demanding a strict sequence that you had to obey. So for example, if you were having a great moment of feeling suffused by light and everything streaming through your body, say, this couldn't be real because I haven't visited the dark yet. I mean, that would be terrible. So whatever you're lucky enough to bump into it. Nevertheless, in terms of a sort of typical or classical sequence, maybe immersion in the dark comes first. And we'd, in association with that moment, we'd recalled Hakuin, talking about his own experience of that, saying the whole universe was sheer darkness, or Linji saying that in this moment, it's like an ice cave a million miles thick. And then one of the places we'd ended last time was the wonderful story of Hakuin going to see the person who becomes his teacher and presenting an experience of profound darkness or nothingness. And his teacher asked him about it, and he said, nothing whatsoever to take hold of, you know, nothing anywhere. And the teacher, of course, reaches out his hand and twists Hakuin's nose really hard until Hakuin screams. And the teacher says, oh, I have no difficulty taking hold of it. And so that sense that this, you know, the profound sort of quietness of sinking into dark, of sinking into something that's like nothing left at all, is an important point, but it's not the end point. And so what we're interested in today is really sort of traveling those branches of light back up into the daylight world and back into moments of illumination and maybe what comes after that. So we've been talking both about the Shito poem and the Heart Sutra that we say during our sutra service as kind of intermingling. The Heart Sutra formulation that would have something to do with some of this would be Shariputra: form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form, form is exactly emptiness, emptiness exactly form, sensation, perception, mental reaction, consciousness are also like this. And then to go back to the Shito, just a couple lines, one would be, the notation that branches of light stream from that dark. So as soon as you go into that dark, or maybe not as soon as, but out of that dark comes this bright sense of light or illumination. And then related to that, someplace else in the poem, trying to control things is only delusion, but hanging on to the absolute isn't enlightenment either. So you don't want to hang on to that moment of nothing there. As we talk about coming back to the light, one of the things that we'd mentioned last time was that strange formulation that Norman quotes of Katagiri Roshi in his somewhat strange English. But so Katagiri says you get to that moment and you stay there for a while and then you bounce. And what I like about that is partly the comic sense and the sense that what happens next seems sort of unexpected and irreverent and inconsequential. And also that sense that the shift can be very abrupt. And I think that's not always true in practice, but very often it's the case you're someplace and it can be very trivial or frustrating or very deep. And the next moment, you know, maybe especially in a retreat, but not only, the next moment you're someplace really different and you need to be willing to go there. Now, one of the things from the Shitto that we quoted a couple of times is a kind of strange formulation of what might happen or what might be true when one returns to the light. We and everything we perceive are interwoven, and we're ready for that, but we're interwoven and not interwoven. And this interweaving continues on and on while each thing stands in its own place. And so that brings us back to those two koans and that paradoxical sense that one of the things that we're likely to feel very strongly after a profound experience of immersion in the dark and then getting sort of blasted back up toward the light is a tremendous sense of interweaving. Another thing we're very likely to feel in another moment is a very profound sense of not being interwoven, of only I above the heavens, below the earth, am the world honored one. So I wanted to talk at least about the interwoven part, and maybe we'll get to the not interwoven, and if not, we'll do that in a couple weeks. Okay. One formulation I like is Norman Fisher's, and Norman says on occasion that things are so interpermeated that we can't even say that because there aren't any things at all. There's just interpermeation, and the very notion of a thing that would then be interpermeated overstates the case, or understates the case of interpermeation. I want to read you a physicist that I got to through an odd series of connections in some way. So this is from David Bohm, Chance and Causality, Causality and Chance in Modern Physics. And this turns up as the epigraph to the book of poetry by a terrific poet who died recently, Leslie Scalapino, who's very close to Norman, was one of the literary executors for Philip Whalen and a longtime Buddhist practitioner. So this is sort of physics, you know, revealing Buddhism to itself. This is kind of a long quotation. So Bohm says, "Nature may have in it an infinity of different kinds of things. In terms of the notion of the qualitative infinity of nature, one is led to the conclusion that every entity, however fundamental it may seem, is dependent for its existence on the maintenance of appropriate conditions in its infinite background and substructure. This interconnection can, under appropriate conditions, grow so strong that it brings about qualitative changes in the modes of being of every kind of entity known thus far. This type of interconnection we shall denote by the name of reciprocal relationship to distinguish it from mere interaction. In this process, there is no limit to the new kinds of things that can come into being, and no limit to the number of kinds of transformations, both qualitative and quantitative, that can occur." It's getting wild now. "But if all things eventually undergo qualitative transformations, then the process described above will never end. Thus we conclude that the notion that all things can become other kinds of things implies that a complete and eternally applicable definition of any given thing is not possible in terms of any finite number of qualities and properties. Thus we see that because every kind of thing is defined only through an inexhaustible set of qualities, each having a certain degree of relative autonomy, such a thing can and indeed must be unique, i.e. not completely identical with any other thing in the universe, however similar the two things may be. Carrying the analysis further, we now note that because all the infinity of factors determining what any given thing is are always changing with time, no such a thing can even remain identical with itself as time passes. We admit also that nevertheless there exists an absolute, unique, and objective reality." And so that's a I don't know if, so that's a picture of this wildly sort of profoundly inner universe of nothing but relations. I want to say a little bit about some of the ways that might feel in practice. One of the senses can be of sort of riding those waves of light back up into the daylit world and being really overwhelmed by a sense that, as Joan likes to say sometimes, everything that we see is just the play of that holy light, that everything in some sense shares that radical equality of being something else that's woven and interwoven with everything else out of that light. I had one moment in a retreat that I'll say a couple things about my own experience, which was kind of nice in that it began really trivially. It was a pretty deep into the retreat, and it was actually at Mountain Cloud, and I revisited the particular object. The windows were open, and there was a really light breeze, and there was just this little plastic tassel at the end of a window shade that was gonna, you know, be used to open or close it. And it was a hollow plastic thing, and it was funny because in the breeze, there was just enough sort of weight to the object, neither too much nor too small, that it was really just kind of held by the breeze in a funny way. I mean, it wasn't like going way up in the air, but you could sort of tell that, just the way if you put something in water, you could tell that exactly where it was in the water was a function exactly of the density of the water and the density of the object, that there this thing was floating, you know, and it was so completely just a function of everything that was around it. And I had a moment just, I don't know where it came from, but I just said, I'm just like that, you know. And then I walked around just with that feeling for hours. And I went outside, and so there's that sense of sort of everything moving as it moves because it's held in what it's held in. And I just felt that the air was like water, you know. It was almost like I was sort of surfing just during the long walk outside, and could really feel the air buoying me up. And another thing that might happen in moments like this, I guess I've said this already, but it's a sense of kind of the radical equality of everything in that sense, so that on the one hand, nothing's like anything else, but on the other hand, here we all are. And I remember going into breakfast, and the light was still just gleaming really, really brightly, and I noticed that I was going to eat a boiled egg, which I really like, and some granola, and it's hard to put this into words, but I thought, this is really strange, you know, I'm a thing, and right now I'm going to eat another thing, you know, and it just seemed really funny, you know, it's a really sort of wonderfully, richly comic, you know. So that sense of, you know, just being awash in the sea of things that on some level are not any different from other things. And a very profound sense that, you know, like that tassel, that for me to be just provisionally the object that I was so clearly, you know, dependent on this whole field of things that was really infinite. And the sense of that was really quite visceral and very settling in some way. I want to do a little digression. We'll end pretty soon, but for the academics in the group, one of the funny things about this is that there was a period in the 1970s within the academy when French structuralism and things like that started, you know, hitting and offended a lot of sort of common sense Anglo-American thinkers. I remember showing a friend of mine from college who was not an academic, an academic paper, and he said, this is ridiculous. You have entities that are abstract performing actions. So you would say the society does this or the field of this does that. And it occurred to me that, to me, it wasn't ridiculous at all that I'd read enough stuff that was my sense of it, you know, that it's not true that the person does this. It's a little bit like Obama saying you didn't build the bridge, you know, that the whole structure built the bridge. But that was very much true within a certain style of thinking. And so, you know, just quickly, two areas that were pretty influenced by that were linguistics and structural linguistics. So the sense that it's not true that first, there are a collection of independent words, each of which means exactly what it wants to mean as a particular word. And then the individual words get together and say, we're kind of, you know, we sound a little bit like, let's decide we're all part of the English language. But that you had to have the language first before you could have, and that there are no individual words outside of the structure of the particular language that makes them possible. And within anthropology, the same thing, you know, so you'd say, well, within contract theory, I guess, you know, first there are these individuals running around in a state of nature, each being themselves, and then they say, life is too nasty, short, and brutish, we're fucked, let's come together in society and make a conglomerate. But within structural anthropology, the notion that there were independent people before there was a conglomerate doesn't make any sense, that what we mean by a person is so much a function of that conglomerate, which is not to say there are no dogs before there are human societies, you know, but for that particular entity to be there, the structure has to be there first. There's one particular formulation that I like. I hope this resonates for people in a way that's not just intellectual. There's a Freud, who I think is quite wonderful, though problematic. The standard edition, there's a translation, he's talking about the ego, you know, the conscious self, and the id, or the sort of primordial goo out of which it arises and from which it differentiates itself. And he says that, he's talking about the task of psychoanalysis, and he says, there where id was, let ego be. And then there's a wonderful sort of colonialist metaphor for that. He says it's an endless task, like the draining of the Zuider Zee in Holland. So it's like, you know, the infinite task of trying to drain the muck away enough so there can be dry land where things can be cultivated. So it's very much a metaphor of sort of doing battle with the goo out of which each thing comes. And the French psychoanalyst Lacan, who claims that he's returning to Freud, and maybe he is, and so he'll say, well, I'm just correcting the translation. But Lacan's formulation of the same moment goes like this. He says, there where it was, I should like it to be understood. It is my duty that I should come to being. That's got a really different feeling to it. There where it was, I should like it to be understood. It's my duty that I should come to being. So exactly in that moment where the infinity of interpermeations and interrelations are, that's where myself will come out into the open. So insofar as there is a self, it's dramatically and inextricably a function of all the stuff that it comes out of. And I think the Buddhist sense is that, you know, whether we're human or dogs or ants or rocks, that's very deeply true in terms of any number of varieties of structures. So that's probably enough for today, but that sense of the interpermeation of things as potentially being quite profound. And I guess the other thing I'd like to say about it is that it seems to me, of course, you don't stay in that moment where you feel that, you know, the air is water and it's billowing you around, or it would be odd to go through your whole life saying, the key is I'm just like the window tassel. You know, that would be an odd kind of thing. But that those moments really leave a very deep residue that can kind of stain the rest of what's going on. And I want to talk a little bit about that next time. The other thing I want to plant for next time is to say, how strange that if that's true, if there's that profound sense of interpermeation, it should also be true that another response to coming back into the light is above the heavens, below the earth, only I am the world-honored one, you know, Whitman's barbaric job. And again, a plant that I mentioned last time, which we'll get around to next time. Strangely enough, you know, so the little Chihuahua, and Chihuahuas are great because they're tiny dogs that think they're big dogs. You know, people say Chihuahua's like a little dog. I mean, a big dog in a little dog's body. You know, it's got this sort of, so strangely enough, you know, to have it be an important Buddhist moment when your Chihuahua's out in the yard and he's just tiny and he just, you know, and he knows that he's the ruler of the fucking universe, you know, that's a profoundly Buddhist moment in some way. That's another place I want to go next time. So that's a trailer for where we're going next. So thank you.
Is that what you're just describing? Is that what you would say is codependent arising?
The Chihuahua or before the Chihuahua? Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then I guess what I like is that there's, I think it's really important to supplement the codependent arising with the Chihuahua. Do you know what I mean? That the both those things are important. Yeah, we'll see.
I think you should give disclosure that you have such a personal connection to Chihuahuas.
Well, I have a Chihuahua in my house, you know. If you live with a Chihuahua, you definitely. The other Chihuahua person who hasn't been here much lately is Roberto Bedoya, but he's a real Chihuahua guy, so he's got. Yeah. I think his family, all his aunts and stuff, have Chihuahuas.
You know, that's one way of looking at it.
Yes. I do. Yeah. Well, one place I want to be headed with this is. How strange in a way, but how in keeping, especially with the practice we're getting from Joan, is that these apparently sort of wildly different senses of what it is to be in the world or what it is to be a person in the world, that they're all there, you know? And one of the things that means is that the practice can be pretty inclusive, you know? So if you're having a moment where it's just darkness and you say, yeah, let's go with that. If you're having a moment where everything feels interdependent and you're not in the dark, that's great. And if you're having a chihuahua moment, you know, I just hit the fucking home run, that's great. That, you know, you don't have to say no to that either.
Right. So. No, I meant the chihuahua. That's what
yes. I'm looking at. Yes. Don't tell that to the chihuahua.
No, I won't.
Anything else by way of question or comment?
I think you ought to bring the chihuahua and sit.
He won't sit. You can't teach a chihuahua to sit. Well, I guess we'll close then.
Okay, well, we could do a couple of announcements. Are we sure that anybody who has something you'd like to respond to in the talk? Or it just struck you?
That's fine.